I don't know if we fully appreciate what it was like to be occupied by Rome. So Rome knew that their soldiers had needs. Mm-hmm. And they didn't want them to be married. That held them down. So they gave them the right to have any non-Roman citizen woman they wanted. Mm-hmm. Could you do any, you know, if that happened to someone that you loved?
You would hate the Romans.
Would you be able to not try to join some sort of a, you know, I don't want to call them sicarios, that's nowadays, but the equivalent, right? Mm-hmm. These folks that just had these curved blades that just, you know, they keep them in their the cloak. Zealots. They're just standing there and they just, you know, they stab the guy and walk off and, mm-hmm. you know, and then the guy falls. And but you'd have a lot of sympathy for that movement, mm-hmm. you know? So you become a Christian and this centurion falls in love with Jesus too. Are you going to, you're just going to sit next to him there in church? You know, this guy could stop. He's over 100 Roman soldiers. I mean, that's a lot of power, especially when you have one group of people who are armed and the other who aren't. Mm-hmm. You know, they can do a lot of damage. 100 Roman soldiers with the gladiuses, and you've got, you know what, a stake. So all that to say is that the church, it was defied a lot of the divisions politically.
Welcome everyone to the Faith Recovery Podcast. We're trying to recover faith here by recovering the faith.
Yes.
And that over there is Nathan.
It's me.
And I'm his interpreter, Kent. And we are in a series called The Voice of the Shepherd. And The Voice of the Shepherd is that message that you hear as you live out the Christian life, telling you which way to go, left or right. Not so much like, you know, whether literally to turn left or right on the street, but ethical decisions. Moral choices in life, and the guidance comes from the shepherd. And what's the voice of the shepherd sound like? It sounds like the gospel. It sounds like death and resurrection. It sounds like humiliation, exaltation. It sounds like, trust and self-giving love. Anyway, these themes in the gospel guide us through life.
Definitely.
So what we sort of laid the groundwork in the first several episodes about the gospel and understanding the gospel more richly. Now we're trying to apply it in ethical dilemmas of life. Mm-hmm. And this week, well, we're just after the inauguration. It would be a perfectly relevant episode any other day, but we just had the inauguration. It's very relevant today. Thinking about politics, thinking about the polarization in our nation. Polarization is always there. It comes and goes. We're kind of at a high point right now, it seems like. And I think it's an ethical dilemma for Christians because in the church, we are called to love one another. And yet, actually, we hate those who, many of us hate those who are opposite us politically.
Yeah.
What do you do about the fact that the culture is training you to demonize and hate those who are opposite you politically, ideologically? When Jesus calls you to love your brother and sister in Christ and be one with them and to have one mind. It's hard, and churches are splitting over this, and churches sort of, and people sort of self-organize in different kinds of churches, progressive churches, conservative churches, and so you feel that when you go to church, you're safe to spout out your political ideology because you think everybody there shares it, and to some extent, that may even be true because of how we organize along ideological lines.
Yeah.
However, it's never completely true, and in fact, in every church, there are people on both sides of the political aisle. But we're called to love one another. What do we do about the fact that the culture would have us despise one another? And there's a very strong pressure to think and act and speak that way. That's the ethical dilemma that I think we're in,
yeah.
And that I think the gospel speaks to. So that I'd like for us to discuss today.
Yeah, buddy. Where to go? Yeah, so much, so much there. I've seen it happen. So. Just a couple of vignettes, I guess, and I think I mentioned these folks before, but there were some folks that were at our little church, and the church was really frustrating and backward, and the leadership was intractable, and there was lots of reasons to leave that church. And I had actually left that church in 2003, went to a larger church, got on staff. Long story short, I came back as the minister at that little church, which is, I guess, a sense of irony that God has, but... while I was there, those people had been there through thick and thin, you know, the whole way. They stayed when we left, and they had just tried to make the most of it. So they were really faithful. They'd been there 20-something years, okay? But then during the first Trump era, they just couldn't be there anymore. They were just like, I didn't know I was going to church with these, you know, Nazis or whatever. And I was just like, these are the same people you've been with for decades, you know. But something about it, they just couldn't tolerate that there were Trump supporters in our church, or maybe even the majority of the people in the church were Trump supporters. And that was just a bridge too far for them. They left, went to a more mainline Protestant church, and subsequently became non-Christians. They just renounced their faith. And as they were processing, they were just like, if Jesus can't keep people from voting for Trump, then the gospel doesn't work.
I think I've heard other stories of people who, in the Trump era, have decided not to be Christians anymore. This really strong feeling of, I don't want to identify with these people, and if these are the Christians, then I'm not a Christian.
Right, yeah. And for them, they just really saw it as a failing on the part of the gospel, of, you know, all of this stuff. If this can't, after 2,000 years, get us to a point morally where we, you know, are aghast and appalled at Trump's policies or whatever, and that anybody would support those, and so.
And I'm you know, and I'm surrounded by people who have the exact opposite reaction.
Yeah.
Like they just, you know, they can't, you know, comprehend how someone could be a Biden supporter or a liberal or a Democrat, you know. And I, you know, so it goes both directions, of course.
Yeah. I think it's interesting in the New Testament, and I don't know if we can fully appreciate it because, you know, we're looking back, and we've mentioned this before, that it's hard for us to put our minds in the place where the first readers of the scriptures, the New Testament letters, where they would have been in their culture, their ideology, their assumptions, and especially if you were, say, an observant Judean Jew, or even a Jew of the diaspora, but especially one in Judea. The idea that Roman soldiers might be in the same synagogue as you, because
They're the occupiers.
If you look at church, church was just synagogue on Sunday. Yeah, I mean, they took, like, synagogue was presided over by elders. The New Testament apostles appointed elders in every town. You know, it was
they did what they knew, which was synagogue.
Yeah, it was a gathering in the round and stuff. Yeah, they knew that, and they retained a lot of the exilic mentality. I mean, synagogue was not something. I challenge anybody to find anything that resembles synagogue in any of the Hebrew scriptures. It's not even mentioned, right? But it's something that just evolved out of this 400 years in this exilic thing from the Babylonian captivity through, you know, the various other kingdoms, and even up to under Rome. You have this diaspora of Israelites who realize that they have to form communities. They have to have a touch point. They're all off on Saturday, you know, and they're not going to temple. There was no temple through that exilic period. And, so what do they do?
They're off on Saturday because they're Jews.
Right.
And there was even, I think, provision in the Roman culture for the Jews.
Yeah. Not always, but it was. So there would a Caesar would rise to power, would be friendly to them, everything would be great. Another one would rise who hated them, and everything would be terrible. So, and I can't remember all the way that it was, but, you know, under Augustus, I think that everything was great, but, you know, when Titus and Vespasian and those guys came in, obviously everything was horrible, right? But yeah, there were special provisions made for them. And that was really, I think, in the tradition of Cyrus the Great. Cyrus the Great realized that, you know, you can't overcome somebody's culture and their kingdom. I mean, in their culture and their religion, their faith. That if you do that, you're always working, you know, uphill. Mm-hmm. You're going to have resources that are diverted from actually your empire building by people who had uprisings and resistance, and, you know, people who are willing to die en masse rather than bend the knee. It just wasn't worth it. You know, you could think about the stories of Daniel and stuff, and this opposition between Daniel and his friends and the emperor of the world, right? So Nebuchadnezzar and all that. And really, historically, you see this battle between the Jews and their conquerors, and ultimately the Jews win in to some degree. You know, as the prophets kind of were talking about, you're going to go into exile, but then you'll have them right where you want them. You know, that there's this idea that that God's not just allowing his people to be defeated in 586, but 586 BC, but that he's scattering them to pepper the earth with the knowledge of him, right? So these synagogues become that. And this is an exilic mentality, right? This isn't something that's wrapped up in the nation. It's not about political power. Their way of having synagogue was like, even if they were all Jewish women, they could still meet. Now, it wouldn't technically be synagogue, but they would meet for prayer. You know, if you didn't have enough men, there was like a quorum, a certain number of men that had to be there for it to officially be synagogue. I think it was like 10 men or something. And if you didn't have that, they had provisions. So they could be in very small numbers. So when Paul is called to go to Macedonia in that dream, and he gets there and he doesn't meet, you know, in his dream, a man from Macedonia says, mm-hmm. come over and help us. But when he gets there, he doesn't meet a man. He meets a woman, right? And Lydia of Thyatira. And then when they, you know, they meet her, she becomes kind of the householder of this new church, this new synagogue. But when synagogue begins to meet there, it's still her and her people. You know, it's her household. It's the people that are connected to her that become this alternative synagogue. So it's really telling when we look at the New Testament, and you have a couple of times where a centurion is the hero. Mm-hmm. And it's always in the in kind of the context where he is put in relief against this kind of Jewish bigotry against the Roman Empire, right? So you have everyone's crucified Jesus, you know. Well, let's go back earlier. So this centurion either sends Jews or to Jesus, or he comes in person, depending on which of the two Q Gospels you read, Matthew or Luke, right? But he comes to him somehow, right? Either he sends somebody or he comes in person. And he asked him to come heal either his son or his slave. Those were the same word, his boy, right? And so Jesus is like, okay, you know, the fact that he approaches Jesus, that Jesus is okay. And also, here's the thing, that the one thing that a Jew would do in the ancient world, if they were observant, the one thing that they just would not do would be to cross the threshold into someone's house, a Gentile's house. Like, you and, you know, if you're a Gentile and I'm a Jew, maybe we will meet over here, you know, mm-hmm. and we'll meet
at the well.
I don't know, at the well, or yeah, at the, you know, someplace that's a common area, and we will talk, mm-hmm. right? Maybe you could come to my house, you know, and we would eat, like we were very good friends, or mm-hmm. maybe we were part of the same guild, or our lives were enmeshed in every other way except religiously. But then if you said, hey, you had me over last week, why don't you come over this week? And I was to be like, oh, I'm sick that day, mm-hmm. right? You know, ultimately, I'm just like, I can't be polluted by going into your house. There are just too many things there that are not kosher. Mm-hmm. So when Jesus is ready to go right into the guy's house. Now, the centurion knows that this is not the tradition, right? Mm-hmm. So he stops him and says, you don't need to come in. I believe that if you give the command, right? Mm-hmm. So Jesus, it was, you know, the record says that he marvels at the guy's faith. Mm-hmm. So here's this proclamation that this centurion, I mean, it's hard to imagine if, let's say you're a Southern black in the 1950s in Mississippi, mm-hmm. and a white sheriff comes through where you and your friends are hanging out. What's happening to your autonomic system, mm-hmm. when he,
right,
when
you're
he
getting up, you're in. Getting up regulated. We might be about to get in trouble here.
Right. Right. That's, I think that was the experience of the Jews. You have people who are very manifestly different. These Jews, right? The way they dress, the way they cut their hair, They're trying to go on about their lives, but they don't have certain sets of rights. I don't know if we fully appreciate what it was like to be occupied by Rome. So Rome knew that their soldiers had needs. Mm-hmm. They didn't want them to be married. That held them down. So they gave them the right to have any non-Roman citizen woman they wanted. Mm-hmm. Could you do any, you know, if that happened to someone that you loved?
You would hate the Romans.
Would you be able to not try to join some sort of a, you know, I don't want to call them sicarios, that's nowadays, but the equivalent, right? Mm-hmm. These folks that just had these curved blades that just, you know, they keep them in their the cloak. Zealots. They're just standing there and they just, you know, they stab the guy and walk off and, mm-hmm. you know, and then the guy falls. And but you'd have a lot of sympathy for that movement, mm-hmm. you know? So you become a Christian and this centurion falls in love with Jesus too. Are you going to, you're just going to sit next to him there in church? You know, this guy could, maybe he could stop. He's over 100 Roman soldiers. I mean, that's a lot of power, especially when you have one group of people who are armed and the other who aren't. Mm-hmm. You know, they can do a lot of damage. 100 Roman soldiers with the gladiuses, and you've got, you know what, you know, a stick. So all that to say is that the church, it was defied a lot of the divisions politically. So Gospels, you have the centurion at the foot of the cross. Surely this was the Son of God. That there's an official endorsement, not just of Roman soldiers, but, I think it's a by speaking of these noteworthy centurions, it's kind of an endorsement of all of that rank and file, at least, mm-hmm. the Roman rank and file. So you'd say a sergeant and the infantrymen and the privates, you know, at least those folks, right? Now, the higher-ups, maybe not as much. Somebody like a Pontius Pilate, not going to really be a sympathetic figure. But, you know, and Paul, he had a very positive regard for Roman law. He appreciated the Pax Romana, you know. He's like, these people are here to keep the peace, to enforce decency, you know, that mm-hmm. that generally, you know, he appreciated that there was a level, a political level where the political powers had some sort of regulatory authority, like
under God.
Yeah, like, you know, you may want to defund the police, but, you know, do you want to fund the cartel, you know, if your choices are one or the other, because there's always something going to come into a power vacuum, right? So those are problems, but that I'm just showing how they, number one, how hard it was for people to come together as just Christians in the first century.
Yeah, and they had polarization too.
Yeah. Yeah,
they had their differing political ideologies, right. commitments, polarization, demonization.
Right.
Also, right. Jews and Samaritans. You know, we see mm-hmm. that in the Gospels, the demonization of Samaritans. And,
right. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. And as well as there's Gentiles. This call, and really always this holding up of the outside group or the hated group, you know, the empowered group or the marginalized group. Always that this. The person that's rejected previously by the worshipers of Yahweh become, really are promoted past those who are observant Jews. Mm-hmm. You know, that there's these examples set of a Sidonian woman, centurion, you know, these mm-hmm. these ones that would have been, you just assume that this is a horrible person, irredeemable person, right?
Right.
And we see Jesus redeeming them. And, you know, what a declaration of the power of God.
Yeah.
What a rejection of the power of God when we need to be in a homogeneous group,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah. Right.
That the gospel just is just a nice thing to have. You know, this is really a country club. Maybe it's mm-hmm. a political activist,
yeah.
you know, club or something or organization.
It's just civil religion at that point, right?
Yeah.
We the Christians, we're the good people. We're the conservatives, the Republicans, mm-hmm. Maybe even go so far as we're the white people, the European of European descent, you
yeah.
know?
Yeah. Yeah. Kind of a Rush Limbaugh church or something, I guess.
And that may be like maybe a former day, but now we have, you know, we have multi-ethnic churches, mm-hmm. but even in some cases of these multi-ethnic urban churches, you still have this politicization,
right.
and this ideology that is we're the good people because we're the conservatives in the culture. We're supporting MAGA. That's just typically. I mean, there's I could come up with an example of some progressive left group as well, and we're the Christians who support progressive causes. And there are those as well. What's more dominant, I think, in Christianity in America is to support the right.
Yeah,
but it takes both expressions, and they're both expressions are the political captivity of the church.
Yeah, and I think that with Trump, there are probably fewer Christians who identify as right-winged or whatever than there were, ironically, because of things like the alt-right and, you know, the association, so many associations that it becomes, you know, kind of a whole, a label or category. You know, people who are okay with, you know, being somewhat lumped in by somebody else with Nazis and skinheads and stuff like that, you know, maybe they're over there, you know. But there are some people that, like, the dilemma really became from the popular media, but also I think a lot of times within, and not even just progressive churches, like, you know, and I don't want to call out other podcasts, but thankfully we don't have really enough of an audience to give these people any kind of problem. But, you know, the Holy Post with Phil Vischer, and I appreciate them, and they're, you know, I would call them moderates. Right. But and I'm listening to them. But, you know, they are without exception anti-Trump.
Oh, yeah.
You know, with, you know, so there's three or four, you know, anybody that comes on the show. We're all assuming that any decent person who has a shred of compassion is anti-Trump, you know. And so that's an example of somebody that's not really a left wing. They're not liberal theologians. I think, you know, say 12 years ago or whatever it was, that they would have readily voted for Republicans, you know.
Yeah, they're Mitt Romney Republicans. That's what, you know, there's something like that.
Right, yeah. So, you know, Trump, I guess, apparently is so bad that, you know, even the abortion issue, and now it's not.
Kind of not an issue.
It's not an issue anymore. Federal. But, yeah, but, you know, for some, before it kind of became clear that he didn't really care that much about it, people are ready to just be like, look, even this, you know, it's not worth it keeping this guy around, right? So I think that between right and left, you know, a lot of evangelicals slid left some because they felt that there was this watershed that if you support Trump, you're in favor of, you know, hurting other people or whatever, you know, that you're on the side of white supremacists and bigots. And then if you, you know, whatever else you do, as long as you don't support Trump, but supporting Trump is a moral decision. It's a watershed. You know, once you become a Trump supporter, then you're a bad person. And
that's a different moral decision that we're not even here to talk about today, is like how to vote and how can I support someone like Trump and how would I work through that decision?
Right.
And today's discussion is like what happens after that.
Right. How do we accept that person on the other side?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, but I think that the answer has to somewhat be that those two answers are somewhat related and maybe interwoven. That so I think that to your point and to the question is that we've got to get two things in hand. One is, this is not a virtue-driven movement. It's not about morals or virtue or, you know, whatever. And I think a lot of people would know that. But I think a lot of people are attracted to Christianity because they just direly want to be good.
Okay, so you mean Christianity is not a virtue-driven movement.
Right.
It's not about morals.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people just, they want to be good. They want to know they're good. They want to know that they're with the good people. Mm-hmm. You know, they want to fit the category of good people. So when the dilemma became, are you going to support Trump or be a good person? Mm-hmm. You know, I think a lot of people found that they, you know, that dilemma became too much for them. And so they really, which speaks to the people that I mentioned at the beginning, you know, they've been in that church for all those years, right? And they were part of pro-life rallies. I mean, the church had been pretty political. They're pretty pro-George W. Bush and other things, you know. They were all about it. But there was always this assumption, and I think that this really speaks a lot to just the general defection from the Christian movement and, you know, across the board, even without Trump, even before Trump, the, you know, over the issue of LGBTQ, which we've been talking about, that are you going to be a Christian, a bigot, as, you know, a bigoted Christian, or are you going to be compassionate and in favor of rights? Right. So anytime the dilemma is, will you be a Christian or will you be a good person? It used to be that being a Christian was, you know, and everybody knew it wasn't, but that was the assumption that being a Christian is the best way to be a good person or to be seen as a good person, to be in the camp of the good people in the 90s. You know, Nick Bargatze, the stand-up comedian, is like, you know, the 90s is the most Christian time of all to be a Christian, you know. Anytime. Not even the first century, right? Yeah. And he may be right. You know, I mean, you think about all this stuff with the Passion Movement, the VeggieTales. I mean, hey, if you grew up as a kid in the 90s, dude, you were on a pillow full of frankincense and myrrh, dude. You were just, you know, living large. But that at that time, it was kind of like people who identified as non-Christian were like, well, you know, part and parcel of this is, you know, their argument would be, well, I may not be a good person across the board, but at least I'm not a hypocrite, you know, whereas people in the other camp, you know, whatever they thought. But the assumption is if you're a Christian, you're a good person. And I think a lot of people identified as Christian because they knew identification, that, you know, that place in society was endorsed as the good people. Mm-hmm. You know, the moral majority used to be synonymous with the religious right, you know, in Nixon's rhetoric. So to be a good person is to be in church. But that changed. And now in many people's minds, to be a Christian is to be a bigot and to be close-minded, narrow-minded, to cause suffering to other people through your political stance and stuff like that. So, I think that happened. And so the way we vote, the way we identify in the society, that it pushes back against whether you're going to be thought of as moral or good. And I think that maybe it's a purifying moment in the church that we're clearing out the good people. You know, I know that sounds kind of weird, but, you know, Paul was like, he told the Corinthians, look around the room.
You mean clearing out the nominal Christians, the people who identify as Christian just because it's been the thing to do.
Right.
Well, to be seen as a good person.
I wouldn't even say they're nominal Christians. I mean, if somebody's driven by the need to feel like a good person, and I'm a church leader, and I leave the impression that being very involved in this ministry and doing that and, you know, coming at this time makes you a good person, you'll do that too. You'll be very involved, you know. But I think that the gospel calls us to just leave. We have to repent of our virtues as well as our vices. And I know that sounds weird to some, but I think especially if you have a society where Christianity has had a major influence on the mainstream and, you know, and all of the culture wars and stuff, we were really fighting to keep this profile of what a good person is somehow to coincide with what a Christian is, you know, and that, you know, if you view porn, you're a bad person. And if you don't, you're a good person, but you're also probably a Christian. You know, that there were these divides, and I'm not saying should view porn. I'm just saying that when what we need is to be seen by others as a good person, if the rhetoric in our society as to what defines a good person, we begin to internalize that and we aspire to it, and it shifts and changes our behavior, then we quit processing the gospel. Because the part of the gospel, part of the experience of following Jesus is bearing accusation, you know, and if there isn't anything in your world where somebody's like, you know, this thing, and we have to be free from that profile and that mentality and that aspiration, you know, it's just very... It's very liberating. We have to be free enough to confess our sins and not need to maintain a facade, you know? So But all that to say is that some of the dilemma is, if I need to be in the group of the good people, right?
That's
what does that
drive.
Say about? I mean, why can't you be in church with Hitler? Why does that affect you? You know what I'm saying?
So if our drive is to be in with the good people, then that's not a Christian drive. That's a human drive.
Right.
And it's a fleshly and a sinful drive, ironically.
Yeah.
And but if that's and that's a defection of the gospel, mm-hmm. a defection from the gospel and from true Christianity. And your point is, we did that a long time ago. We did that long before Trump.
Yeah.
And we American Christians were operating that way a long time ago, mm-hmm. and it's really just come to a head more recently.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think throughout the 20th century, it was assumed that a Christian was a good person. And politically, the political parties, you know, in a majority Christian nation, the political parties tried to emphasize that their positions were Christian values, right? So, I mean, it was assumed, and I recommend that people read Kevin Cruz's One Nation Under God, because it really kind of takes the blinders off as far as the relationship between Christianity and American politics throughout history. You know, when people get up and talk about this being a Christian nation and all that, I mean, that's just so stupid. Number mm-hmm. one, that doesn't exist. And I would say it's heresy mm-hmm. to even use those two together.
Mm-hmm. When the Bible says
it's so perverse.
That the church is the nation of
right.
God, the people of God.
Right, that, yeah, that we've already begun to see the Christian movement not as having a political component, but just simply being moral training or whatever, then we've already lost our way. I mean, once someone uses Christian nation together as, you know, Christian as a modifier for nation, they've already, I mean, they didn't know the gospel, or at least they need hardcore re-education in the mm-hmm. gospel. Mm-hmm. Like, that's just... And we could go into it later, maybe in another episode, as to why that's so perverse. Like, I can't really express, but I'm gonna use a word, okay? That when we speak of Christian nation, we are sliding over into the camp of Antichrist.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's how serious it is. I can't emphasize it enough. And the reason I'm trying to emphasize it is because it's been so prevalent that people just take it in stride. They just assume, you know, that 2 Chronicles 7:14 is about the USA. Come on, man. You know, it's not. Jeremiah 29:11, you know, all these affirmations to the nation are about us. I mean, it's just bonkers, you know, to think about that. But why do people think that? Well, it's a very convenient. So here's
because the politicians want them to think that.
Well,
is that what you mean?
Yeah. And not only that, but the pastors. So if you're with over a mega church, right, you have a degree of influence, or even over a, what's the opposite of a mega church, a minor church, right? You have a degree of influence and power, right? That you can't really, in some cases you can command your people what to do, but now that's a cult. But anyway, you really can sway the mentality and the behavior of people from the pulpit, thousands of people.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you sway all of these people to be more generous or kind or whatever in their personal lives, more faithful to their spouses, more fulfilled in their faith, right? That's one thing. But, you know, that just doesn't do much for my ego. You know, a lot of those wins just happen in private away from me. I don't really ever see it.
That doesn't build up much of a kingdom for me.
Right.
Me, the senior pastor.
Right. But, you know, a congressman wants to meet with you.
Right.
You know?
No, a political coalition, no, that's power.
Right. Right. Now you try to sway your people one way or the other because you have some real, like, power to change this world. Hey,
yeah.
You know, changing eternity is fine. I just can't see it.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
But I can change this world.
If we can change laws and policies in our country, then we would really feel like we're making visible, observable changes.
Right. So it's a really unholy alliance. But the irony is that, you know, in the Roosevelt era, in the early part of the 20th century, Democrats were the Christian party because of the values like love your neighbor and be, you know, have compassion, and, you know, that they were the ones who were like equally distributing wealth. Not really, but they're more about social programs and, you know, taxing the rich and distributing outward to those who needed it, trying to alleviate the suffering and the poverty in the world. And everyone knew that Democrats were the Christian party. Now the Republicans, they were the just basically just greedy, you know, evil, like people with money and power who weren't afraid to use it, right? And that was the Republicans, you know. And so that was just assumed that. But again, this is all political rhetoric, you know, that, I mean, it was Jesus telling FDR to go to war? Maybe. I don't know. But, you know, it's not a Christian value. It's not like if someone strikes you on one cheek, you know, stab him in the back. You know, that there's a proportional response. I mean, that's what that's what governments in the world do, right? Mm-hmm. If someone hurts you, you come back with a proportional response. It would be folly to not. Mm-hmm. Well, what did Jesus call us to do? Right. If we begin to apply the kingdom values to the politics of this world, it's going to be a very, very short-lived kingdom. You know what I'm saying? So, but somewhere around toward the end of the FDR period and in the 40s, late 40s, after the, you know, all the stuff, we finally were beginning to recover. The war was over. World War II is over. We're beginning to recover financially. So all these completely cold-blooded materialist Republicans are beginning to really thrive and flourish, right? And so they've got all the money they need, but now they want some power. But they're seen as implicitly unchristian. Well, that's a problem politically in a majority Christian nation, right? Until, I can't remember the pastor's name, but there's a pastor out in Southern California who really became one of the first megachurch pastors by preaching this gospel of that dependence on the state is unchristian. He began to, you know, especially as communism was ascending, and communism came with ungodliness. Communism came with atheists. Mm-hmm. There's your democratic policies over there in Russia and China. Mm-hmm.
And they, right, associated those policies and, with godlessness.
And that, and the state has become a god to them. That's unchristian over there. Mm-hmm. Now, all of a sudden, there's a shift.
Right.
You know, when In God We Trust became the national motto?
I do believe it was in the 50s, wasn't it?
It was. And at the addition of One Nation Under God, then the Pledge of Allegiance was added. 1953 to 1954, those two things were added to our national psyche. That's pretty recent. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, why did we do that? partially because I think Eisenhower was a committed Christian and really saw his role as president as an opportunity to bring Christian values into the mainstream. Mm-hmm. I really do think he was sincere in that. I don't think Nixon was, but he used it as much as anybody, you know. And he's the one that coined the phrase moral majority. But that's really when it flipped. But that just goes to show that political parties benefit by claiming that their position is the Christian one. Mm-hmm. And so Christians are in this dilemma. What we need to get past, I think, politically is this sense that that our faith and our and ought to shape the country that we're in. Okay? That's what, Paul had no aspirations toward that. He didn't think, you know, and if we preach enough, you know, Caesar will become a follower of Christ. I mean, yeah, Jesus said you will preach before kings and all that, but usually as their prisoner, mm-hmm. you know, and oftentimes just as a testimony, judgment's coming on this system, and it is, mm-hmm. but we live in the system right now. Mm-hmm. So for me, I'm okay being with somebody of any political persuasion because I know politics are penultimate reality.
Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. We make them ultimate.
Right.
That's what we're doing in our culture today. We're making politics ultimate.
Right. I mean, I may think someone's political position is folly, but I wouldn't say it was evil. you know?
Or that it doesn't. I mean, and you may even have political opinions such that you actually believe that believing in such policies is evil and it would produce evil. But you're not going to accuse that person of being evil for that reason. At most, you're going to accuse them of being misguided and just swept up in the culture.
Right.
One way or the other.
Right. Well, think of any issue.
And are you even going to accuse them of that? You're just going to love them as your brother, and you know they're going to feel loved by you. And in that context, it's going to be a safe place to talk politics.
Right.
But politics is not going to dominate your relationship or determine your relationship.
Right. Right. And I mean, politics may have an effect on the way I live and other things. But and I'm glad you brought that up. And what we need to understand is that the gospel is a call to be a part of a kingdom, really, really, really a kingdom, not just a kingdom later, mm-hmm. but to function as, with an economy and welfare and all of the things of a kingdom, that our interrelatedness is our worship. And that as we form these kingdom colonies, we model the way it's going to be. Mm-hmm.
Right.
And so if in a church we said, as a church, we want to hunt down immigrants and deport them.
Right.
Yeah. It sounds like a great idea. Yeah. You know, and
you might even imagine churches joining with the new federal government in that effort in today's climate.
Right. Let me tell you a story. Okay. So back at that church, that little backward church, right? And everybody there is right-wing except this family that mm-hmm. left. And some of the most right-wing people, they're way beyond me, you know, and I'm somewhat on the right. But, like, I look at them and go, oh, my gosh, you're old and white. It's, just shut up, you know. And, I mean, I have that sometimes, okay? And this person just typifies it. Like, she's at the very top of that pyramid of that white Republican, slap a veneer of Christianity on the top of it. But, it's not fair because I do think she's genuinely a Christian, but she's not the type of critical thinker that would separate the two. She's mm-hmm. just been told that being a Christian is being a good Republican, and she's bought it lock, stock, and barrel, okay? So she's in our church, right? And she and her husband, I say she because she's the one that had some means, some resources from a previous marriage. Her husband died. That's all of the story. And she's also the one that I would say, oh my gosh, this person's just, has blinders on. Then there's somebody else in our church who was an illegal immigrant.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
Now here's what happens. This girl wants to get married and she wants to have, full legal status so she can go to college, she can better herself, and her husband or fiance really wants her to have that because he's got his legal residency. If she doesn't, he doesn't want to just always be having to look over his shoulder or whatever. Mm-hmm. So this woman, the right-wing woman, pays everything it costs to send her back to Mexico to live with family members, to apply for residency from Mexico, mm-hmm. and to get it, and welcomes her back here. Mm-hmm. What does that say?
So the family bond they have in Christ overruled the Republican lady's political sensibilities, right?
Yeah.
And it trumped it. There's trumped our word.
It. Yeah, there you go. Well, when this happened, Trump wasn't in office. He hadn't even run. But here's somebody who would be for, on a policy level, they would be for securing our southern border.
Yeah. Maybe it's inaccurate. Didn't actually overrule the political sensibilities. They were kept in their separate realms properly.
Right.
Right. This person was this illegal immigrant was a person, a sister in Christ to love. Mm-hmm. That you can practice that love while also believing we should secure the border and deal with illegal immigrants however we need to.
Right. So, and I mentioned before, we as a family sponsored a family to come over here. They got their visa, kind of walked alongside them, just helped them navigate everything. We took responsibility financially for them and everything, okay, so that they could come here. But I voted for Trump in 2020, mm-hmm. Same with this lady, she, used her own means to help somebody to get their residency. Things are never as simple as people would like to see it. I would like to know, you know, just how many people who are so rabidly anti-Trump because of his immigration policies have actually paid for and, you know, leveraged their own family income to help people come into the country, you know. And so I really think that, you know, it is about what you do, you know, and that someone's position on public policy doesn't necessarily mean that they want others to suffer, that there are no positions where somebody says, well, I'm in favor of abortion rights because it's just so evil. And I just, man, evil is awesome, you know?
Right.
Has anybody ever been like, you know what? I like dead babies. I just want people to just kill babies. That's my favorite.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Has that ever been the dilemma? Has anybody ever been in the dilemma between evil and good and evil in the political sphere? Look, people are for, you know, they're for good. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, in the fallen realm, we can't really get good. All we can get is less bad. Mm-hmm. So you have to choose your bad almost. You know, do you roll over women's rights over their own body for the sake of, you know, a 6-week-old fetus, right? Or do you allow just unchecked literal killing of humans, you know, non-born yet humans for the sake of somebody's rights? And that's not an easy answer, not biblically, not politically. You know, there's been a lot of things. Now, there have been some things, as we look back historically, that have just been straight evil, and people didn't know, and they would couch it as good. So I'm thinking about Jim Crow laws, stuff like that. Obviously, evil.
There's a time to take sides politically because it's the right thing to do.
Right.
And we should have the maneuverability morally and ethically to go with whoever is right.
Right.
Because we want to see what's right done.
Right, but let's say you're just rabidly pro-life, and the pro-life candidate is in favor of segregation.
Uh-huh, right.
Yep. And you feel like you must vote. You know, what do you do, right? Again, people aren't choosing evil. All of us have very complicated moral choices to make politically. It's so lazy and simplistic and honestly self-congratulatory to brand a set of people as evil and say I won't be around them. It's really perverse. It's not the gospel, you know. And I've mentioned before, but it bears mentioning again, that, you know, when Paul calls the people in Romans 14 to tolerate each other, to receive each other, okay? So let's say all of your friends are observant Jews, and it would be a great scandal if you went down to the idol's temple and bought some lamb that had been sacrificed to Jupiter. It would be a great scandal. Like, you'd be spitting in the face of Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego. Your whole tradition. I mean, it's hard to imagine, right? But, and Paul says, don't do that. You know, don't, obviously, your conscience wouldn't allow you to do that. Don't. It's not his counsel in Romans 14 to do that, but he says, accept the people who do. Mm-hmm. Right? And then he says, for even Christ did not please himself in 15:3. But as it is written, the insults of those who insult you have fallen on me. Right? He's saying guilt by association. Jesus accepted it. Mm-hmm. But I don't want to be with those people. They voted for Trump. Mm-hmm. Or they voted for Kamala. Mm-hmm. You know? We're really distancing ourselves from Christ when we do that.
Right. Who do we associate with? Christ, right, or the political leader, right, of our choosing? Who do we identify with? And we talk about identity politics, right, and I think that may be a good way of framing the issue. Who do you identify with?
Right. Yeah. So, and I know a lot of people, especially because we have a quote-unquote democratic system and who you vote for, and we feel like guilt by association because we voted for this person. Mm-hmm. So it means that we're obviously endorsing them. But again, we're not given the choice between good and evil. We're only given the choice between a messy, complicated political position over here and a messy, complicated political position over there. Mm-hmm. And what somebody says they're going to do may not even be what they're going to do, you know?
Right.
Or they may be ineffective at it or whatever, right? So it's not the choice that we're given. You know, if you're given the choice to vote for evil or to vote for good, I recommend you vote for good. Mm-hmm. Until those show up on the ballot, let's not just summarily judge somebody for their political position. We don't understand the good resident in the choice that they're making. Mm-hmm. You know, I knew a guy who was I would call him a proto-libertarian. Maybe he's a libertarian a long time ago. You know, this is back in the, I guess he wouldn't. The libertarian movement's been around a long time, but he was a libertarian before there was so many of them. Mm-hmm. And, but, you know, he was talking about when they passed the smoking ban inside in Fayetteville, you know, and he was talking about how he was against that. And I was like, well, do you smoke? He's like, no. And he's just like, he just didn't think it was, that the government should tell a business owner what he could allow somebody do within their business. Mm-hmm. If you don't like to smoke, don't go to that business. You know, I mean, if you don't want to be smoked on, mm-hmm. you know, everyone will vote with their dollars. And right. that was his right. position. Now, I'll say in retrospect, I'm so glad that's there, you know. Mm-hmm. But I'm so glad that's there because that was my preference that was imposed on somebody else.
Yeah, right.
Right? Mm-hmm. So what was the good? You know, it's hard to argue for smoking indoors. Mm-hmm. But that wasn't what he was arguing for.
Right. He was arguing for the freedom of the business owner.
Right. Right. So there's...
And there's a valid argument.
Right. Again, and I think most people have a valid argument for what they're doing. And could we not just extend that kind of a grace?
Uh-huh. Right. Yeah, like in therapy, you learn that the people who hurt you had their reasons. Mm-hmm. Like they had their own story.
Yeah.
And there's actually a reason they did what they did that makes sense if you put yourself in their shoes.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of what you're talking about, how to look across the aisle politically and see these people, they mean well. Mm-hmm. And even if you are sure they're wrong, you can at least attribute to them, they mean well.
Right. Well, and this was a challenge for me. I don't know. Somewhere along the line, I realized that I ran into somebody and I couldn't justify their actions against me. You know, I can't remember what the situation was, but I couldn't relate. You know, like I really do. Uh-huh. I try to relate and say, if I were them, what would I do what they were doing and all that? And many times, most of the time, I'd say, yeah, you know, I can kind of see where they're coming from and that helps. But I've had times where there are people that I just don't, you know, it's just like they did something and it was purely self-serving and
they have their reasons. Cost, that doesn't mean it's not selfish.
Yeah, but their reasons were because they wanted it for them, yeah. Right? Which doesn't, you know, doesn't help. I'm not like, oh, well then, you know, I understand now and they're trying to, you know, mess everybody over for their own benefit. Of course, you know, that makes perfect sense. That just makes it worse, right? But then I realized that it's in those moments that the only thing we have is mercy. Mm-hmm. And that's what we have to, and that muscle is way harder. It's way harder to engage than just trying to empathize with the person who hurt us. But to say, you know, I can't relate to what they did.
Right.
And I would never do that to somebody else. Mm-hmm. And yet I'm going to forgive them anyway.
That's what our Lord did.
Right.
And that's something we, you know, that's a different angle on this issue. Another reason to embrace and accept our brother or sister who is wrong, mm-hmm. you know, politically, ideologically, or we're so sure of it, right? We can just forgive them as the Lord forgave us.
Right.
If nothing else, right?
Right.
Even if we can't, you know, see what their good intentions are. Mm-hmm. We can't comprehend that. We can at least forgive them.
Right.
As the Lord forgave us. Accept one another as Christ has accepted you, Paul says in Romans 15.
Right. And that's probably the most subversive thing you can do.
That's a great conversation. I hope it's helpful, y'all. If you have questions, if you want to continue it, you can email us to discussion@recoverfaith.org. Thanks. We'll see you next time.